But like I said, I just don't know. A few birds squawk at one another and take flight from a nearby tree. The fluttering of their wings startles me for a moment, and I sit up. I would have thought the closer I got to death, the less on edge I'd be, the less afraid I'd be. It's turning out to be the opposite.
"I'm sorry,"
he says, taking his hand off my back and tucking it into the pocket of his pants. "No," I say. "It wasn't you." He raises his eyebrow.
"The bird scared you?"
I want to tell him that everything scares me now, but I stay silent and let him ramble on about how birds are harmless. He is drinking more and more wine, and I am trying to keep up, but my head is dizzy, and my eyelids are starting to feel heavy. I roll over on my side to face him. The fire is still going strong, and the tendrils of smoke cast shadows over his thin cheeks. He's been chugging the wine in silence, and I know I should say something that will make him understand how I feel, but I'm already on rocky ground, and I don't want to make it even worse.
"I'm scared too, you know,"
he finally says. I can smell the wine on his breath as he lifts his face, moving it closer to mine.
"But also excited."
I squeeze my eyes shut. My brain feels like it's swimming. "Have you ever heard of Einstein's theory of relativity?" He takes another long sip.
"There you go again with science. You're a real nerd, aren't you?"
"I think to be a nerd, you have to be smart." He draws his eyebrows together.
"You seem pretty smart."
I wink at him. I put on a good act. I sit up and pour myself a little more wine.
"So tell me about it."
"The theory?" The wine has started to taste less sour. I don't know if that's a sign I'm getting used to it, or a sign that my taste buds are drunk. I don't even know if taste buds can get drunk.
"Yeah, Einstein's theory. Your nerdy theory."
His words are sloppy and blurred together. It'd be kind of cute if it wasn't also kind of scary. "You know he had two theories, right? The special theory of relativity and the general theory of relativity." Roman shakes his head.
"I don't know shit about Einstein. And honestly, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't really care about the guy."
"I make you care about Einstein?" I bite on the rim of my plastic cup. He gives me his half-moon smile, all crooked and sweet.
"I can't help but care about the things you care about. I feel like we're kind of connected in that way now."
I find myself smiling. My cheek muscles feel different. They're like a room that hasn't seen light in years that suddenly had all the blinds pulled open and the sun is beaming in at full volume. And I can't help myself. My smile keeps stretching, wider and wider. That's the nicest thing Roman has ever said to me. Hell, that's the nicest thing I can remember anyone ever saying to me in the last 3 years.
"I made you happy,"
he says. His words come out heavy and slow. "Yeah, you made me happy." He shakes his head and closes his eyes. He's swaying back and forth like one of those hula dancers that people put on their dashboards. "What?" I say, and reach over to tap his shoulder.
"I can't make you happy. We can't let each other make each other happy."
I pause, decoding his sloppy, slurred sentence. I lean in toward him. "Would that be so bad?" His eyes snap open. They're bright and glossy, and at the same time, light and watery,
That would ruin everything.
It takes me a second to find my grounding again. I pick up a twig and start dragging it across the grass. But you told me at the carnival that when I talked about science, it made you happy, and maybe... He raises his hand in the air, signaling for me to stop talking.
It doesn't matter.
He points at me, and then back at him.
This can't matter. This is temporary.
His eyes widen, and I can see that red semicircles are forming around the bottom of them. Too much wine for frozen robot.
Look, Azel.
He reaches out and squeezes both my hands in his.
I know this is confusing. We're in a strange and fucked up position, and we can't let ourselves get fooled by the situation.
I try to jerk my hands away from his, but he doesn't let go of them. His fingers dig into my knuckles. The situation?
The fact that we're suicide partners. We have this intimacy. And yeah, sure, we have chemistry.
Chemistry? I can't help but laugh.
Okay, I'll leave the science to you.
He leans in close to me. His nose bumps against mine, and I can feel his eyelashes fluttering on my skin. I lift my chin, and our lips meet. It's clumsy, but it's perfect. I can't stop thinking. We're kissing. I am kissing Frozen Robot. We're kissing. It rings in my ears like a cheesy mantra. I keep kissing him back, and I try not to think about whether I am doing it right or wrong. My heart is pounding, which I think means I like it, and I hope his heart is pounding too. I know humans have been kissing since the history of time, but right now, in this very moment, it feels like kissing is a secret that only Roman and I know about. After what feels like only a second and also 100 years, he pulls away slowly and brushes a strand of hair from my face.
We do have chemistry, he says.
I give him another smile. That's two. I can't develop a smiling habit. I wouldn't even recognize myself if I became someone who smiles voluntarily. I guess we do. I take a breath and notice that the air has changed flavor from campfire smoke to sweet vanilla, and there's a soft sound in my head that I don't quite recognize but reminds me of pennies being tossed into a fountain. The pitter-patter of wishes. Desperate wishes. He nuzzles his head into my neck, and I try to relax my body and pretend like that's perfectly normal. Then he wraps his arms around my waist and pulls me down to the ground with him. We lie there in the darkness, in silence, a few feet from the tent, my spine against his stomach, his hands on my sides. I've never been so aware that I am made up of bones and skin, and I can practically feel my bones inching closer to the surface of my skin, aching to get even closer to his. Out of nowhere, he whispers,
"But this can't change anything."
I squirm so I can press myself even closer to him. I can feel his beating heart. It is wildly alive. There's a burning in the pit of my stomach, and it feels nothing like the black slug chomping away at my happiness. There's a light fizziness where there used to be unbearable heaviness, and I wonder if my potential energy is changing. I imagine graphing the whole process like a scientist would chart her lab experiment. My whole life is starting to seem like an experiment.
"Azel,"
he says, as he holds me tight, his lips brushing against my hair.
"You know this can't change anything, right? This type of happiness is fake. It's fleeting. We need to remember why we want to die. I need to remember Maddie. And you need to remember your reasons."
My reasons. That sounds so vague. But I guess I haven't really told him my reasons, since I'm terrified of how he'd react if he figured out who my dad is. And maybe that's why I haven't told him. Not because I'm scared that he won't want to die with me anymore, but because I'm terrified that he'll still want me to die, that he'll agree that I should die. I guess he's right. I am a flake. But maybe meeting Roman has helped me to understand myself better. Yes, I'm broken. And yes, he's broken. But the more we talk about it, the more we share our sadness, the more I start to believe that there could be a chance to fix us, a chance that we could save each other. Everything used to seem so final, inevitable, predestined. But now I'm starting to believe that life may have more surprises in store than I ever realized. Maybe it's all relative, not just light and time like Einstein theorized, but everything. Like life can seem awful and unfixable until the universe shifts a little, and the observation point is altered, and then, suddenly, everything seems more bearable.
"You know," he presses, "us doing whatever we're doing, becoming whatever we're becoming, it doesn't change anything. It can't."
His actions don't match his words, though, because as he's talking, he's pulling me closer.
"I know,"
I whisper. But deep down, what I know is this. Everything has changed. Sunday, March 31st. 7 days left. I'm woken up by the glare of the morning sun. Roman's arms are still wrapped around me, and I roll away from his grasp. We fell asleep a few feet from the tent, and my shirt and jeans are streaked with muddy grass marks. I pull my phone out of my pocket and see I have a missed call and voicemail from an unknown number. I start to walk away from where Roman is sleeping. But I stop when I hear him sleepily groan in my direction.
"Where are you going?"
He sits up and rubs his eyes.
"What time is it?"
"Almost 8 a.m.
"Ugh."
He flops back down on his back and squeezes his eyes shut.
"It's too early and too bright."
"Someone had too much wine," I say, in as normal a voice as I can. I know he said that last night didn't change anything, but I don't know how to act like things haven't changed. He's no longer Frozen Robot, my suicide partner from the internet. He's Roman, the boy who kissed me by the river and held me all night. To me, there's a difference, a big difference. He's no longer the person I want to die with. He's the person I want to be alive with. "I'll be right back," I say, and head off toward the river. I walk down the same path I did yesterday. I look at my phone's screen again. I missed the call around 7 p.m. last night. Maybe I'd already drunk too much wine to notice my phone vibrating. I press my ear to the phone and listen to the message. It's Jacob, the guard from the prison, calling with information about my dad. My breath shortens as I replay the message. Jacob located someone who works at St. Anne's Behavioral Health Hospital who knows something about him. Jacob gives me the name of the person, Tara Woodfin, and her number. I replay the message again and then glance down at my phone. It's probably too early to give Tara a ring, especially on a Sunday. I'll have to wait a bit. Once I get back to the campsite, I find Roman in the same position I left him. He's lying on his back, his eyes squeezed shut, and his face frozen in a painful frown. I kneel down beside him and shake his shoulders. Come on, we should go. Let's take down the tent.
Why do we have to leave so early?
His speech is still slurred, and he rolls over on his side. I walk over to the tent and try to figure out how to collapse the thing without breaking it. I fumble around with the poles until I figure out that they can be removed from the tent's flaps, and once they're out, you can bend them in half. I'm sure there's an easier and prettier way to take it down, but Roman's too zoned out to judge me, and if he has his way, he's never going to need to use this tent again anyway. The thought is almost unbearable, and I push away the sinking feeling, swallowing the lump in my throat. Stay busy. Don't go there. Once the tent has collapsed, I shove all the parts into the bag Roman packed it in. There's no order to it, but I'm sure Mrs. Franklin will fix it once we get back. As I head toward the cooler to grab a bottled water for Roman, I notice his backpack slumped next to it. I peek at him to make sure he's still sleeping and unzip it. I pull out his sketch pad. I know it's wrong, but I can't help it. I sit down cross-legged on the ground and flip through his sketch pad. My breath catches when I reach the last page, the drawing of me. The girl I'm staring at is not me, but she is me. Her large eyes are focused away from the viewer, but there's something in them I don't immediately recognize. Hope. Her posture looks straighter than mine, like she's stronger, more resilient. Thank you, frozen robot, I whisper to myself. I tear the drawing out of the sketch pad. I don't care about how angry he'll be when he realizes I took it. I need it. I need it to remind myself that I can be this girl, that this girl is inside of me, this hopeful, strong person. I fold the drawing into a tiny square and slide it into my pocket, and then carefully put his sketch pad back inside his bag. As I pull a water bottle out of the cooler, I think about what I have to do. I have to do for Roman what he has done for me. I have to show him the person still inside of him, the person he thinks is gone and defeated. A boy full of adventure and talent, with a sloppy smile and an infectious laugh. A boy with eyes like summer grass and sunshine that see things most people don't. And hands that create incredible sketches. I close my eyes and I remember holding his hand at the carnival, how solid and tight his grip was. I have to help him save himself. I have to. Taking a deep breath, I muster the courage to walk over to Roman. I crouch down beside him and press the cool bottle to his forehead. Wake up.
Hey!
He yelps out in surprise. I figured that would feel good.
It does, thanks. It just startled me a little.
He takes the water bottle from me and rolls onto his side so he can gulp down a few sips before pressing it against his forehead again. I'm going to put everything in the car and then we can take off, okay? I'm about to get up. But he reaches for my hand and pulls me back down to the ground beside him.
I wasn't so drunk that I don't remember last night, Azelle.
I stare at him blankly. I can't say what I want to say. And I figure silence is better than all the words he doesn't want to hear. And besides, I don't want to speak until I have the right words, the magic words, the words that will convince him to live. He shakes his head and takes another gulp of water.
Don't pretend like you don't know what I'm talking about.
I stay silent and run my tongue over my teeth, searching for the right words.
Azel,
he says as he reaches for my hand again. I grip his hand and stare down at it, the hand that drew that picture. Jacob called, I say. His fingers softly massage mine.
And?
He gave me the name of someone I can call to get information on my dad. Roman drops his gaze to the ground, but keeps my hand in his.
We might not have time to visit him before...
I know, but... I pause and inhale, letting the cold spring air fill my lungs. About last night, I know you told me not to let it change anything, and maybe last night in particular didn't change anything, but I'm starting to think that maybe we should stop and really consider... everything. I stare down at our hands. He drops my hand and scoots away from me. I take a sharp breath.
Look, I knew it was a bad idea. It's just your...
He sputters like a stalling car's engine. I'm what?
You're you. You get it. You get all of it. And you're sad like me, and as screwed up as that is, it's pretty beautiful.
He reaches over and brushes his hand across my face, touching my hair.
You're like a gray sky. You're beautiful, even though you don't want to be.
But he's wrong. It's not that I don't want to be. But I never wanted to be beautiful because I was sad. Frozen Robot, of all people, should know that there is nothing beautiful or endearing or glamorous about sadness. Sadness is only ugly, and anyone who thinks otherwise doesn't get it. I think what he means to say is that he and I are ugly in the same way, and there's something familiar, comfortable about that. Comfortable is different from beautiful. I think about his drawing of me. The girl that he drew, she was beautiful. That girl wasn't a gray sky. She had hope. Hope is beautiful. And I don't want us to be ugly in the same way anymore. I don't want to be a gray sky. I want us to find hope, together. I look away from him to hide the fact that my eyes are welling up. After a few moments of silence, I stand up and dust myself off. We should probably get going.
Azel,
he says, and there's an urgency to his voice.
We should talk about this.
I know, but I don't know what to say. He squeezes my hand. And all I can do is squeeze back, because I'm too scared of letting go, of losing him. Sunday, March 31st. 7 days left. We've been driving for about an hour when I pull off the highway to stop at a tiny diner that was advertised on a billboard near the exit. Roman's been sleeping the whole ride, and he slowly wakes up as I park the car. He rubs his eyes.
Where are we?
I thought it'd be good if you ate something before I dropped you off at home. He gives me his half-moon smile, and my heart feels like it's being strangled. I can't look at that smile anymore. I glance out the windshield. Rain pours down from the sky. And off in the distance, I hear thunder rumble.
I like your thinking. You're right. My mom would totally flip if you brought me home in this condition,
he says as he steps out of the car.
You'd lose your Saint Azelle status.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose that if I let you jump to your death from Crestville Point. I bite down on my bottom lip. Roman doesn't react to the rain. It falls on our hair, our faces, our clothes. We walk slowly into the diner and get seated at a booth in the back. He looks at the menu, and I find myself staring at him. He catches me, and I drop my eyes, reading the omelet choices over and over again. I pretend to be really interested in the difference between the Southwestern and the Florentine choices. When I'm sure he's not looking at me, I sneak another glance. His t-shirt is damp with rainwater. His hair is soaked, and beads of water pool on his forehead. The rain, the water, makes him look younger, more alive. It's made his cheeks redder, his skin brighter. I try to picture it on a grander scale, how he'll look after diving from Crestville Point, how he'll look after the water has drowned him. His lips turning from a pale pink to a cold blue, his skin changing from dewy to impossibly pale. I wonder if we feel those transformations, if we can sense our kinetic energy fizzling away into nothingness. I wonder if we can hear it, if it sounds like the symphony, or if it sounds like screaming. I don't know the answers to any of my questions, and I don't want to know them anymore. I don't want Roman to know them either. I go back to silently staring at my menu. I can't think about any of that right now. Our waitress comes over to the table and takes our order. 2 eggs, bacon, hash browns, and a side of jalapeno peppers for him, and a Florentine omelet for me. She's probably around my mom's age, but her hands are much more wrinkled, and her face has a lot more meat. Her hair has clearly been dyed blonde, and the roots are dark and greasy. Good choices, she says with a smile as she scribbles our order. She looks out over her notepad at us, her smile widening. Y'all are a cute couple, you know that? I bet you get that all the time. Anyway, I'll be back soon with your food. Before we can correct her, she walks away. I pick at the booth seat's cushion, which is splitting down the middle and oozing fabric stuffing.
You can smile, Azelle, Roman says. She thinks we're a cute couple.
Right. A cute couple. I look directly at him, and he drops his eyes to the table. Our waitress returns quicker than I expect, which always makes me nervous about the food. Then again, we're eating breakfast in the middle of nowhere Kentucky at a run-down diner, so I guess the quality of the food is pretty much already established. I don't have an appetite, so I push my omelet around on my plate, my fork making little scratches on the dull white surface. Roman, on the other hand, shovels bacon into his mouth, chewing loudly. It's funny how once you like someone, even the unattractive things they do somehow become endearing. I hate it. Also, I'm not sure how he can have an appetite at a time like this. Did he completely forget about our fight by the campsite? Did he forget that April 7th is only a week away?
Can I ask you something?
Roman says, in between chews. He's moved on to the eggs. He's covered them with the jalapeno peppers. He pops the peppers into his mouth, sucking down the seeds. Sure. I take a gulp of the tap water the waitress brought us.
When are you going to tell me exactly what your dad did to get himself locked up? All you've said is he's in prison.
He trails off. I pause and study Roman's face for a second. His deep-set hazel eyes have brightened since eating, and he looks genuinely curious. I tilt my head down so I can stare at the metallic tabletop instead of his face. I'm torn between using his curiosity to my advantage and actually having to tell him the truth. As terrified as I am, I like to imagine he'll understand. The boy that drew that picture I found seems like the type of boy who would understand.
So, does this mean you're not going to tell me?
I don't look at him. I can't. I close my eyes for a second and hum a familiar song under my breath. As I hear the music starting to build in my head, the part where the notes gain momentum and begin to sound like they're reaching for something, I get an idea. I lift my chin and meet his eyes. I'll tell you exactly what my dad did, if I can ask you something too. Fair deal?
Depends on what it is.
Okay, here's the question. If you weren't going to die in 7 days, what would you want to do with your life? He sets his fork down and glares at me. His eyes go from bright to stormy in all of 3 seconds.
What kind of question is that?
A curious one. But I guess all questions are curious. His lips wrinkle like he's fighting a smile.
Why are you talking like the Mad Hatter?
You know me, always making bad jokes. He picks up his fork again and takes another bite of his eggs.
That wasn't exactly a joke.
So do we have a deal or not? He gives me a mock salute.
The terms are acceptable to me.
I press my elbows down on the table and lean toward him. So what's your answer? He points his fork at his chest.
I have to go first? How is that fair?
Of all people, you're really going to talk about fair? He shakes his head. His signature smile has worked its way across his face again. I look away.
Fine, fine. I'll go first. It's stupid, though,
he says. My question?
No, my answer.
Let's hear it. I hold my breath. I want to hear so many things, but I don't know exactly what I want to hear. Maybe he'll tell me something dumb, like he's always imagined owning a sporting goods store, so he'll have a lifetime supply of basketballs. Or maybe he'll tell me something heartwarming, like he's always wanted to be a pediatrician, so he could help sick children. But in the end, it doesn't matter what Roman wants to do. I'm beginning to learn that this is the exhilarating and puzzling and frankly frustrating thing about love. Things that matter to the other person start to seem intriguing, even if they are actually quite trite when you really think about them. I once read in my physics book that the universe begs to be observed, that energy travels and transfers when people pay attention. Maybe that's what love really boils down to. Having someone who cares enough to pay attention so that you're encouraged to travel and transfer, to make your potential energy spark into kinetic energy. Maybe all anyone ever needs is for someone to notice them, to observe them. And I notice Roman. So honestly, all I want is for him to have an answer to my question. I just need to know something about him that will make me believe that there's even a sliver of a chance that his particles have a longing to go in a certain direction and only need a nudge.
I'd want to go to college,
he says. I can't help it. My heart leaps with a surge of hope. That's a start. I make a gesture for him to continue.
And I'd want to play basketball there.
I nod. Even though you don't play anymore? He gives me a sly smile.
Well, this all takes place in a hypothetical universe, right? I can be whoever I want to be.
The surge of hope I felt a moment ago is gone. My insides collapse, and I sink into the booth's torn cushion. It doesn't have to be hypothetical. I force myself not to give away my disappointment and say, Fair enough. Go on.
What else is there?
I don't know. What would you want to study? His face flushes, and he shifts in the booth.
Ah, That's the stupid part.
I tap my fingers against the table. Then it's the good part.
You would say that.
I give him a look, and he holds his hands up above his head.
Fine, fine. I'd want to study marine biology. I know it's dumb, but I'd love to explore the ocean.
I grin, and I'm sure I look like an idiot, but I don't care. Like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Like Captain Nemo. His smile returns.
Exactly. I've always been fascinated by the idea of an underwater adventure. But it's stupid, since I've never even been to the ocean.
He stops talking, and his eyes go hazy, distant.
And I guess I'll never go.
I bite my tongue. Maybe not, frozen robot. Maybe not. I briefly imagine us on a road trip to the coast. Maybe we'd head out to somewhere in North Carolina. That's not too far from here. I see him walking along the beach in his UK hoodie, the waves lapping at his ankles. He'd inspect the water, and I'd stay back, sitting in the sand, reading a book on the philosophy of physics or something. We could be happy. And it doesn't have to be in an alternate or hypothetical universe. I need to figure out how to show him that. Maybe I should buy him a book on marine biology. But that seems too heavy-handed. He'd flip out. Maybe I could propose a last-minute road trip to the beach. I wonder if anyone on Smooth Passages would have any advice for me. But that thought makes me bite down hard on the inside of my cheek. I know everyone on that website would totally go nuts if they knew I was changing my mind. And worse, trying to convince my partner to change his mind. That's precisely what's not supposed to happen. And this is exactly why Roman didn't want a flake, but he ended up with a flake. A grade-A flake. Though it's his fault. He's the one who turned me into one. I just need him to turn into a flake, too. Maybe flakiness is contagious. While I've been spaced out, he's gone back to devouring his food. When I come back to reality and glance at him, he's staring right back at me.
Oh, hey, you're back. Did you come up with some pressing physics problem you had to work out or something?
I shrug at him. Now seems like the wrong time to pitch my ocean road trip plan. Something like that.
Well, it's your turn.
Huh?
To tell me about your dad,
he says. I bring my face to my hand and chew on the skin around my thumb's fingernail. It's kind of a long story, and I don't really know all the details. Roman's face hardens.
Don't play games with me. I answered your question. Now you have to answer my question. Straight up.
He lowers his voice, so he's practically whispering.
Suicide partners keep their word to one another.
And I know he's right, but I wish keeping my word didn't mean drowning my heart. Literally. Sunday, March 31st. 7 days left. I convince Roman to let me wait to tell him the story of why my dad was locked up until we get to the playground. I didn't really feel like airing my family's dirty history under the fluorescent lights of the shabby diner. Then again, I was probably just trying to buy time. It seems like all I'm trying to do now is buy time. He's on the phone with his mom when I pull into the playground's parking lot. She's called him approximately 57 times since our trip began.
Everything's good.
He pauses, nodding like he's in agreement with whatever his mom is saying.
Yeah, it was a fun trip.
She must say something funny because he smirks.
Azelle's great. But hey, Mom, I was calling because I'm going to be a little later than I thought.
He starts nodding again.
Azelle and I thought we'd swing by the playground and play a pickup game.
He laughs.
Yes, I'll take it easy on her. I promise. See you soon.
He hangs up and turns to me.
You're really doing your job, by the way.
I blink at him. What are you talking about?
My mom thinks I'm completely normal again. Before, she would have never let me come home later than I was supposed to.
When he smiles, it's different from his half-moon one. It's a calculated one. It makes my stomach flip in a bad way.
And did I tell you she hasn't even come check on me in the middle of the night for the past week? Thanks to you, I don't think she's that worried about me anymore.
I open the car door and step outside. The knot in my chest grows, and I shuffle my gray Converses in the muddy dirt of the playground. It stopped raining, but the air is still damp and cold. I wrap my arms around myself and walk over to the picnic table I sat on the last time I was here. I climb on top of it and press my palms against the wet wood and lean back, staring up at the sky. Roman hops up on the table and sits beside me. I look over at him, and he's shading his eyes with his hand. You always do that, I say.
Huh?
Shade your eyes with your hand. I've noticed you always do that, even if it isn't sunny. His half-moon smile returns.
You're so observant. In another universe, you'd make a really great scientist.
Maybe in this universe, too, I whisper. His posture stiffens. Before I can say anything, he's jumped off the picnic table and is standing with his arms crossed, glaring at me.
Take me home.
His voice is flat. It'd almost be better if he was angry. At least then I'd know he felt something. Come on, Roman, I say, trying to downplay it. I mentally slap myself for saying something so stupid. I should know better than to try to surprise him like that. I need a more subtle approach. He's going to have to come to the conclusion himself. I can't push him there. I attempt to backpedal. I was just saying that to say that. I'm not a complete idiot. He raises his eyebrows, pulling his lips into a straight line. I mean, I was trying to say that if things were different, I could be a great scientist. I pause for emphasis. In this world.
Yeah, if things were different. But what things are you talking about?
He doesn't uncross his arms. The sun has poked out from beneath the clouds, and the sunlight is making his eyes look especially golden. They almost look like they're on fire. My dad, I blurt without thinking. After 3 years of trying to run from the shadow of my dad, now I'm dangling his dark history like some kind of bizarre bait. It's pathetic, really. I've spent so much time trying to conceal the truth from Roman out of fear of his reaction, but now I can't worry about that. All I know is I need him to stay here. Stay with me, and I'll do anything, say anything, that will make him stay just a moment longer.
Your dad.
Roman shakes his head, staring down at the ground.
I don't get you, Azel. Your dad's the reason you want to die, yet you're desperate to see him one last time, despite the fact that you supposedly hate him, and you won't even tell me what he did. Do you really not trust me at all?
I clench my teeth and resist the urge to tell him that I don't want to die anymore, that everything has changed. But I don't think this is exactly the moment to make that big proclamation, not when he's so angry with me. I pat the table beside me, urging him to sit back down. I promise I'll stop messing around. I'll tell you what really happened with my dad. What I know, anyway. Roman pinches his lips together, and I can tell he's contemplating what he should do. In the end, his curiosity wins out. He jumps up and takes a seat next to me. This gives me a perverse sense of hope. After all, being curious by definition means you want to see what comes next. It's a feeling of some kind. I can maybe work with that. I look at him out of the corner of my eye. His head is tipped down, and he's staring at his hands. Roman?
What?
Do you promise not to judge me if I tell you the truth about my dad? He touches my wrist gently, wrapping his fingers around it.
Why would I judge you?
I look away. My throat feels strained, loose, like a tire swing hanging from a frayed rope. It's like any moment it's going to collapse and crash, sink down into my gut, and leave me voiceless. He touches my shoulder.
What do you mean?
Timothy Jackson. Those are the only two words I manage to push out. Roman drops his hand, tucking it behind his back. He spins so he can directly face me. I force myself to look into his wide eyes. It's in those eyes I found perspective and light again. They pushed their way into my black hole. I let out a choking, heavy breath, a gasp for air. I'm so scared of watching those eyes turn from summer to winter, from warm to frozen. He runs his hand along the small of my back.
Zell, it's okay. I know.
Another choking breath. No, you don't. You have no idea. His fingers trail along the base of my spine.
Yes, I do. I know about your dad.
I jerk away from him, moving to the very edge of the picnic table. I pull my knees to my chest and rock back and forth. I try to hum Mozart's Requiem, but I can't hear anything except my own beating heart. It won't slow down. He moves to be next to me and drapes his arm around my shoulders.
Shh. It's okay.
My eyes blur, and a wet ball forms and hardens in my throat. I haven't truly cried in years. I'm not going to cry now. My shoulders shake, and I bite down hard on my bottom lip. My mouth fills with the taste of blood.
Why?
Why what?
Why didn't you tell me you knew?
He grabs my chin and gently pulls on it, so I'm forced to look at him. His golden eyes are still warm.
Because I didn't know how to bring it up. And I wasn't completely sure.
He drops my chin and pulls his hands away from me. He places them on his knees and takes a deep breath.
It was just a hunch I had, based on your name and what you'd said about your family. It's kind of hard to avoid the story. It's everywhere. And I thought that was probably your dad, but couldn't know for sure. Not until I heard it from you.
You don't have to tell me about the story being everywhere. I press the heels of my hands into my eyes. I suck in a sob, refusing to let the tears stream down. My whole body stings with shame. It's not even my dad. That's bad enough. But I can't believe I was so stupid to think that I could hide the whole thing from Roman. I sniffle, and a briny taste crawls up my throat. If you knew, why did you want me to tell you? Why did you keep asking about my dad? He grabs my hand again and squeezes it.
Because I wanted to know that you trusted me. That you felt comfortable enough with me to know that I wouldn't judge you for it. And I wanted to hear the whole story from you.
He tugs on my hand, begging me to look at him. I tilt my head so I can gaze at the side of his face, but I refuse to meet his eyes.
I thought it would be good for you to talk about it. Hell, I still think it would be good.
Why? He shrugs.
Sometimes it helps to talk. It helped me to tell you about Maddie.
My insides jolt with hope. It did?
You gave me something no one else has given me.
What?
You looked at me the same way before and after the story. I want to do that for you.
Fine.
Fine what?
I'll tell you what I know. He lets go of my hand and moves to put his arm around me. I rest my head on his shoulder.
Don't be mad at me,
he whispers. I'm not.
You promise?
Promise. His shoulder is broad but bony, and I can feel his muscles tensing under the weight of my head. Do you really not hate me? Even now that you know for sure that my dad is the crazy guy that was all over the news. I just thought you'd be really upset because... I focus my eyes on a faded soda can that's been tossed under the picnic table. Well, because you used to be really close to Brian Jackson. He strokes the back of my head, running his fingers through my tangled, curly hair.
I promise I don't hate you, Azelle. I could never hate you. And I definitely wouldn't hate you because of this. You didn't do anything to Brian's brother. You didn't kill him.
His sentence replays in my head. You didn't do anything to Brian's brother. You didn't kill him. As I digest his words, my eyes become blurrier and blurrier. A tear rolls down my cheek, and then the flood happens. My body trembles, and I heave. I don't understand why I'm sobbing now, why now of all times, why now, when I finally don't want to die. He wraps me in his arms, and I press my face into the soft cotton of his t-shirt. It smells like a mixture of fabric softener and campfire smoke. He continues stroking my hair, and I focus on his kinetic energy. I don't want him to stop. I want him to stay in motion. He presses his lips to my ear and whispers,
"Tell me, Azelle."
I suck in the damp air, and it fills my lungs. My heart feels like it might burst, and I untangle myself from him. I wipe my eyes and clear my throat. I'm sorry. He smiles slightly.
You don't have to be sorry. Stop saying that, crazy girl.
I frown. See? You do think I'm crazy. Because of my dad. He shakes his head. His smile becoming wider and more crooked.
No, I think you're crazy in a completely different way. In a beautiful way.
My heart stalls. I want to ask him how he can say things like that. 7 days before we're supposed to die. It's not fair. He can't make me love him when he's going to leave me. When he wants to leave me. When he knows this is the end. The tears keep streaming down my face, and he nudges me with his shoulder.
Tell me the story.
I wipe the snot from my nose. I stare at his t-shirt, now stained with my tears. I ruined your shirt.
I don't care about my shirt. I care about you.
Something inside me clicks. It's like I've spent my whole life fiddling with a complicated combination, only to discover I was toying with the wrong lock. And now, the vault inside of me that contains all my secrets is swinging open, and I feel this rush of blood swell in my chest. Okay, I'll tell you what I know. I don't look at him, but I swear I can feel him nod. And I can definitely feel his eyes on my face, soft and gentle, like the first snow of the year. We're silent for a while, sitting side by side, shoulder to shoulder. I press my gray sneaker against his dirty white one, and I wish we could stay like this forever. But deep down I know that we can't, and so I finally tell him the story. The complete story. The whole story. My dad and mom moved from Turkey to the U.S. before I was born. At first, they lived somewhere in Michigan, but some relative of my dad's, or maybe it was my mom's. I stop talking for a second and catch my breath. Roman is right. I've never told this story, not since my dad got locked away. It's been whispered behind my back or talked about in hushed voices by my mom and Steve late at night when they think Georgia, Mike, and I are all sound asleep. It's been twisted and manipulated and changed. I've never owned it. Anyway, I continue. This relative ran a convenience store here in Langston, and when he passed away, my parents moved here to take over the store. Roman snorts. I know, Langston of all places. But yep, they moved here, and a couple months later, Mom got pregnant with me. After I was born, I guess they started to grow apart. When I was less than a year old, they separated. Apparently, my dad had really violent mood swings. One morning, he'd wake up at dawn and make her scrambled eggs and toast, but other days, she'd wake up to find he'd smashed a hole in the wall from anger and had locked himself in their small basement study and refused to come out. He was like that when I lived with him, too, but I was too scared to ever say anything to Mom about it. I work up the nerve to look at Roman. He places his hand over mine, interlacing our fingers. "Go on," he says. Dad stayed in Langston and took over the store because he wanted to keep me in his life. I was everything to him. My voice cracks as I say that. And then Mom met Steve, and they got married and had Georgia and Mike, and I'd visit them on the weekends, but I lived with my dad, and he hated losing me on those weekends. I stare off into the distance at the swing set. In the wind, the swing is swaying back and forth, making it look like a ghost is pushing it. I wonder if Roman and Maddie used to come to this playground and swing. I swallow down the salt of my tears. I can tell that Roman is waiting for me to say something else, but this is the part I'm scared of, the part I've never been able to make sense of in my own head. After a long, heavy silence, I say, "One day, I went over to Mom's after school. Usually, after school, I'd meet up with Dad at the store, but this day was special because it was Mike's first Little League game, and I promised him I'd be there. I remember the look on Dad's face when I told him I wouldn't be home until late. Things were going badly at the store, and Dad counted on me to keep him company and help out. That month, Dad was convinced we had a shoplifting problem. He was completely obsessed with it." I pause and bite the inside of my left cheek. I don't let go of Roman's hand. I squeeze it as hard as I can, over and over again, each squeeze a little wish. So I wasn't there when it happened. When Timothy and his friends walked into the store, I was watching Mike run from first to second base. I shake my head and stare at the ground. Timothy and his friends came into the store and started goofing around. They were running through the aisles, and one of them knocked over a display, and my dad, he... I choke over my words. My dad got angry, really angry. He started shouting at them, and Timothy and his friends thought this was really funny for some reason. So they knocked over another display, and one of his friends grabbed a few candy bars and threw them in the air, daring my dad to do something about it. So